Thank you.
That call to order, the first House Committee on Education Subcommittee on Higher Ed. Welcome to our members. A special welcome to our returning members, Representative Lim, who was in Washington, D.C. last week when we first met on full education, and Representative Greenlich. Tremendous to have you here. Very, very pleased. Very glad to see you recovering so well. Just to get us started, in the full education committee, we did do a brief introduction of members and allowed members to talk very briefly about their hopes and their views on our subject matter. I'm Representative Peter Buckley from Jackson County. I represent Southern Oregon University and Rogue Community College, and very proud of those institutions. When the speaker brought forth the idea of having a subcommittee on higher ed, the clear goal was to make sure that higher education received a higher profile in the state after too many years of neglect. And I'm very, very glad to be part of this work with each one of you, and welcome to the committee. The vice chairs for the committee are Representative Clem and Representative Crummell. Representative Crummell's up in the lunchroom. He'll be with us in a moment. Representative Clem, would you like to introduce yourself and anything you want to say? Again, you don't have to repeat the whole...
Do you want me to leave the Sun Bowl champion?
Leave the Sun Bowl champion thing out of it.
College World Series champion. Okay, I'll leave that out. I'm Brian Clem. I'm from here in Salem, and... I have the closest thing that I've got in terms of a public institution is Chemeketa, which I run right up on 45th Street on the backside of the campus. My district begins in that portion of Salem, so I don't have the campus itself, but a lot of faculty and students. And then Willamette University as well, not quite in my district. Some of the housing at Willamette is across 12th Street, the Tokyo International University of America, and then a new Kaneko Hall is in my district, but the body of the campus is not. Many of the faculty do like to remind me that they do live in my district, though, and when going door to door, I met them, and they talked to me frequently about higher ed, both public and private.
Thank you, Representative Greenlich. Would you like to introduce yourself? And
yes, I'm Mitch Greenlich. I represent House District 33. That's Northwest Portland all the way to North Plains. I have the Linfield College of Nursing at Good Samaritan Hospital in my district and the Rock Creek campus of PCC. I've been involved in higher education since I came to Portland in 1964, having been an adjunct faculty at both PSU and OHSU since about 1965. Since before, it was either PSU or OHSU. PSU, I think, came in my second year, and OHSU was named in long after I was there. From 1990 to 2000, I served as the chair of public health and preventive medicine, and a professor of public health at OHSU. I'm very pleased to be on this committee. I've been a legislator for two sessions and voted against the higher ed budget in both sessions because I felt it was frightfully inadequate. I think we've been desperately underfunding and underpaying attention to our colleges and universities, and we just need to do whatever we can to make some drastic changes in that direction because our system is sinking and sinking fast. We also need to think about innovative ways to organize the higher ed system in the state, and you'll hear me comment on those before long,
and more than once too, I'm sure. Thank you, Representative Greenlich. Representative Lim, welcome to this committee. I had the privilege of serving under you in the Trade Economic Development Committee last session, and I greatly appreciate all the kindness and consideration you gave me on that committee. And I hope you have an enjoyable experience on this committee. Would you like to introduce yourself and make any comments?
Thank you, Dear Chair Buckley, and my name is John Lim, representing Gresham area and eastern small portion of Portland. And I served in the House for two terms and 1 year. And then I came to House because I have more friends in House and Senate. So I'm serving the second term in the House. And Chair Buckley that has been serving together of my Trade and Economic Committee in the last session. Now I'm on the your committee. My great pleasure working with you together. I'm sure we can make a big difference in this coming session on the area of higher ed. My district in Gresham, we have a amount of the community colleges. College is one of the largest community colleges in our state. And so I'm fully supporting education at this the session. I'm serving in the full committee of education and also higher ed. And so education always has been the big agenda in my life and in the legislature. So glad to be here working with you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative. At the Friday meeting, I did mention the overall goal for the work of all the education committees that I have is that by the end of this session, that every student, every teacher, every staff member, every parent, every administrator, every school board member, everybody in our state feels in the bones that we have turned the corner and we're starting to build public education in our state again, and that we can build a bright future together. I'd like to also introduce our committee administrator, Derek Olson, who I think all of you have met. Have you met Derek?
I met earlier.
Very good. Derek, would you like to introduce yourself and say a little bit about yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Derek Olson. I'm the committee administrator for the full education committee, as well as the subcommittee on higher education, and then sharing with Rick Berkovian the duties of the committee administrator for the subcommittee on education innovation. I'm a native Oregonian, went to Tigard Public Schools, Tigard High School, and then college and graduate school out of state. After 13 years in the Foreign Service of the State Department, I recently returned to Oregon with my family, and it's a privilege to be working here for the people of Oregon and the legislature, and I look forward to working with members of the committee and members of the public to assist in the work of the committee. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Derek. I'd also like to introduce committee assistant Andy Widrum-Tom, who's here to take care of the committee as well. Representative Crummel, with in theater we call this coming right in on cue. Would you like to take a moment here to just introduce yourself and get going?
Sure. I'm Representative Jerry Crummel. I live in House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. I have some high-growth schools and districts in my legislative district, kind of a mix between suburban and rural in terms of the makeup of my legislative district. I'm in my fifth term.
My gosh.
I've been here probably longer than a lot of people would have ever thought. Anyway, and it's been fun. Let's see. Education. I'm also a teacher. Right. I teach for Oregon Connections Academy, which is an all online school, K through 10, and we will be eventually expanding to K 12. And we offer a very good curriculum and school choice, and that's one of the things that I think is important. So with that, we can get going.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Committee members, just to remind you that we adopted rules for the full committee on Friday. Those rules do apply to the subcommittee as well. If you don't have copies of those or need copies, please let Derek know. I also want to mention some housekeeping things before we get on to our presentations. Given the type of schedule we're working on this session, it is important that we start on time, and we do need to end prior to 3 o'clock because there will be another committee coming into this room right at 3. Our meetings will be Mondays and Wednesdays at 1 p.m. in this room, here in Room D. The full committee meets Fridays at 1 p.m. in Hearing Room F. Folks who are on the subcommittee but not on the full are more than welcome and encouraged to come to the full committee hearings. And anyone who's on this subcommittee is also welcome to come to the subcommittee on innovation as well. And those education innovation subcommittees, chaired by Representative Comp, meet at 1 o'clock on Tuesdays and Thursdays in here, Room D. For our members in our audience, a note from administration, if you could please turn off, not just silence, your cell phones and PDAs. Apparently it interferes with the taping system, even if it's not on loud. A reminder to committee, the microphones are very sensitive, and they pick up the whispers that you might be exchanging. And also a reminder that our committee is on the Oregon Channel. It's being broadcast on TV and via Internet, so please comb your hair.
Can I borrow your comb?
At this point, I'd like to open an informational meeting on legislative priorities of the Oregon University System and community colleges. And again, thank you for our guests for being here. We'll start off with the Chancellor of our system, and welcome, Ms. Chancellor. Glad you could be here. I heard you stay here overnight to make sure you could be here to greet us today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it is my first night ever in Salem.
Oh, my.
I'm not sure if that's good or bad. But thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. My name is George Pernsteiner with the Oregon University System, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today with the committee. This is by way of overview. I'm sure we will have many substantive discussions over the course of the next few months. So I'm going to paint a very broad brush picture, and if you have specific questions about things, please feel free, because I'm sure we'll get to everything before the end of the session. One of the things that animates the discussion that we have with our board, the discussion we have with our presidents, the discussion that we have with the communities in Oregon generally, is really the changing nature of the world economy and the demands that are placed then on Oregonians if they are to be competitive for in that world economy, to increase the level of education and skills from what we've been able to be accustomed to in prior generations. One of the things that you'll see in the packet that's being passed around to you is a comparison that talks about the education attainment of people in the United States, people around the world, and people in Oregon. Obviously, the United States has held an edge in post-secondary education attainment for many, many years. And you can see that that edge continues, although it is beginning to be eroded as other countries, in fact, increase the level of education of their adult populations. But one of the things that I think is noteworthy is that the education level of Americans who are the older members of the workforce and the younger members of the workforce are pretty much the same. The education level of the workforce in the rest of the world, however, for the younger generation is higher than it was for their parents. Mm-hmm. That's not a surprise. They're making the investments. They're now putting an emphasis on education, which they have not done before. But what's a little distressing to me and to others in Oregon is that in Oregon, the older workforce is better educated than the younger workforce. So that even though nationwide that may not be true, it is true in Oregon and in probably about a dozen other states. That is of concern as we move forward, because if our citizens are to be effective competitors in the 21st century and to participate fully in what that century has to offer in terms of the international economy, then the education levels, the education attainment of our adult population, our younger adult population, has to improve. That level is both community college and university. It's not just university. And the table that you have before you, in fact, includes both. So as we speak about this, both the community college representatives and I will be focusing on improving the education attainment level of all adult Oregonians who are in the workforce, primarily those who would be educated through the universities or the community colleges. In terms of our university system, we have 7 campuses. You've probably heard of most of them. Perhaps you've heard of all of them. Perhaps some of them are in your districts. Each of them has a particular mission and a particular focus that will be reviewed this year with our Board of Higher Education to either revalidate or to change the mission of those campuses for the next 20-year planning period. The first of those to go before our board will be Oregon State University, which will have that discussion with the board in February. Perhaps in some ways Oregon State's the easiest. It's the land grant. It has therefore, a defined mission in the way that the federal government defines missions, and there's defined funding that comes with that from the federal government as the land grant, with a focus really on agriculture, forestry, science, engineering, and connections into the community through the Extension Service, through the Agricultural Experiment Station, through the Forest Research Lab, what we call the statewide public services. So in some ways, Oregon State is the easiest to define because, in fact, in traditional sense, it is what we used to view as public higher education. But in fact, the other six serve very important functions in this state. The University of Oregon, which is a research campus just as Oregon State is, focuses on the liberal arts and sciences, has some very fine science programs, and on certain professional programs such as law, journalism, architecture. Portland State University is the largest university in the state, with about 25,000 students, some of whom may be waiting for me to teach them this afternoon or may not. I'm still not clear whether we're holding class this evening. And it's a comprehensive urban university with an increasing research portfolio, but its focus is and has always been on meeting the education and workforce and research needs of the Portland metropolitan area. That is mostly what it does. That's mostly where it gathers its students, and it's mostly where it's very, very fine and nationally recognized programs that involve the community, businesses, and public organizations with the students, where those programs are focused, are on the metropolitan area. Western Oregon University, which is the closest to where we are, is started out life as the normal school, as far as it, as its public mission goes. And it has now evolved into both one of the best education programs around, but also a lot of strong liberal arts programs. And you'll hear a lot more about Western as we move forward, because under the leadership of John Minahan, they have, in fact, begun to do some very exciting and innovative mm-hmm. things that we are using really as a pilot for the way we look at much of the rest of what how we may do business in the future. Southern Oregon University, another excellent regional campus, and I want to say regional campus here because it meets the needs of a certain portion of the state. We tend to think of higher education in traditional terms of 18 to 22-year-olds going away to live on a campus. That is a minority of our enrollment. Most of the enrollment at most of our campuses is drawn from the area around the campus. And that's particularly true of the regional campuses such as Southern and Eastern. Most of the enrollment on those campuses is from the surrounding counties. Most of the people who go there then intend to be in those counties and often to stay in those counties when they graduate. So that the focus of the programs at those campuses often relates back to the economic and social drivers of the communities that surround them. And so if you look at Southern, that's one of the regional campuses, and a lot of its focus will be on the Medford-Ashland area in terms of the kinds of opportunities that are there. It has a focus, an excellent focus, on performing arts and theater. And it is perhaps best known for that. But, of course, that's connected to one of the major industries of the Ashland metropolitan, or the Ashland area. So a regional campus does focus on the needs of that region. And Southern's an example. Eastern is another example. Eastern, though, is an interesting campus. Because although it does it for the largest area, an area larger than Connecticut. It does it for the 10 eastern counties of eastern Oregon, and in fact has to do it from 17 different sites. Less than half the enrollment at Eastern Oregon University is on the campus in LeGrand. The rest of it is at the 16 sites around the state, many of them in eastern Oregon, a few of them in the rural areas of western Oregon, and one of them, frankly, in Portland, where they focus their enrollment on the particular needs of the students there. Oftentimes, what Eastern provides is what others would view as a distance education approach to learning. And it works well for Eastern, and they've begun, and they have been a leader in that field for probably 20 years or more. So they do it well, and they do it from a base in LeGrand, but with 16 other locations. And of course, there's the Oregon Institute of Technology, which has some very focused, very fine programs in engineering technology, and increasingly in health professions, that in both Klamath Falls and in the Portland metro area, that focus on meeting workforce needs in a very specialized way. That basically is the system. We have seven campuses. Our board this year will be knitting them together in a strategic plan that will say to each campus, your role within the portfolio of institutions in Oregon will be X, and it's that because if we take the totality of the institutions, we then provide the breadth and depth of academic program which we think will be needed in Oregon over the next 20 years. And that's something that the board is focusing on this year. As I say, Oregon State will be the first campus, but each month thereafter we will be having discussions with another campus about what its particular role and mission would be within the portfolio. We serve more than 81,000 students in a fall term, for example. That's the highest number ever. It's not as high as we had expected it to be, even though it is still a record. About 14% of our students are students of color. That's important to note because the demography of this state is changing, and we have to be able to recognize and deal with the needs of a changing student body as we move into the future. About 66,000 of those students are undergraduates, and about 15,000 are graduate students. About three-quarters of them go full-time. About three-quarters of them are from Oregon, about 5% are from other nations, and about 20% are from other states. It's important to note, though, that most of our graduates, about 80% of them, when they finish, stay in Oregon. That's very high by national standards. About 20% of our students transferred to us from Oregon community colleges. So, it is, again, it isn't just that people enter right out of high school and go through college. It's, in fact, a mix of ways in which students come to the university, many of them through the Oregon community colleges. In fact, last year, in I guess fall of 05, we accepted, our institutions accepted, more than 630,000 credit hours in transfer from the community colleges towards the degree programs of those students who were transferring in that particular term. We awarded last year more than 19,000 degrees and certificates. Again, that's the highest number ever, and more than a third of those degrees were in those professions that one group or another in the state have identified as being shortage areas. Sciences, math, engineering, teacher education, health professions. And although that's the highest number ever, just as the enrollment's the highest number ever, there are some things I will talk about in a little while that give us a little pause that the number may not continue to grow and that that could have deleterious effects for Oregonians and for Oregon's economy. Our funded research this past year topped $300 million, and donations topped $150 million. To put that in context, the amount of state funding this year will be about $360 million. So federal research is nearly at the level of state funding, and of course federal research and private donations together exceed state funding. That's unusual for a system, but it's not unheard of. We mentioned the statewide public services of Oregon State, the Ag Extension Service, the Cooperative Extension Service, the Ag Experiment Station, the Forest Research Lab, but I also want to mention that our campuses operate what are called campus public services, things you may not think about as being part of a university. The Population Research and Census Center at Portland State University is actually the organization that estimates the population for the state of Oregon and every one of its communities. There's also the Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies, which provides services to and research for local governments and organizations in the metropolitan region, something which the regional research institutes at both Southern and Eastern do for the counties and communities in their regions. We operate the veterinary clinic at Oregon State University. We operate the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. And there's even a radio station at Southern, KSOR. These are examples of many of the public services which are offered, which people typically don't think about when they think about education or even when they think about research. Those are all very positive things, I believe. But there are some warning signs on the horizon, and these are the things that perhaps the committee may want to delve into more as we go forward. A decreasing proportion of high school graduates is going on to college of any kind in this state. Fewer of last year's class enrolled at universities anywhere. Fewer still enrolled at Oregon universities. Some more went out of state. And fewer went to community college. Community college enrollment is down for each of the last several years. What that indicates in some ways is that the 18 and 19-year-olds coming out of college are coming out of high school are not viewing college as an option for them in the same way that they did even 7 or 8 years ago. That is of concern to us. So it's, you know, that may be masked by the fact that our enrollment is higher than it's ever been, which it is, but in fact we're seeing fewer freshmen coming in, and that is of some concern. Our faculty salaries, as will come as no surprise, are lower than those in most states, about 86% of the national average. Our student-faculty ratios are high. Our class sizes are big. There was a reduction this year in degrees awarded and in first-year retention at some of our campuses. We have not seen reductions in those numbers in some years at any campus. That is of some concern, because it means that we're not keeping the students, we're not moving them through to degree quite as effectively as we had in the past. Again, this is something we need to focus on, but I'm not going to try to say this isn't a problem. It is a problem, and we recognize that. We are in this. We have about a $650 million deferred maintenance backlog in our facilities. Several of our campuses are in very financially fragile condition. That's particularly true at a couple of the regionals. But in fact, coming into this year, 6 of the 7 campuses cut budgets. Going into next year, 3 of the campuses at a minimum will be cutting budgets, even if the proposed budget from the governor is adopted. So we are trying to get to a point of a sustainable financial situation, but we're not there yet. But so it is of some concern. We continue to be concerned also that there is a regional difference in terms of college-going rates. Rural areas, students from rural areas, do not attend college at the same rate as do their urban counterparts. And if you care about the entire state and the competitiveness of people from throughout the state, you have to worry, as we do, about finding ways to provide means and incentives for students in rural areas to attend college and succeed in college at the same rate as those in other parts of the state. We are, as you probably know, 46th in the nation right now in terms of state support per student. We're hopeful that in this session that might be improved somewhat. But part of the problem that we're beginning to see, some of those warning signs I've been telling you about here, are probably a result of continued disinvestment over the last several years. And as you begin to have the effects of larger class sizes, less maintenance, less, you know, fewer advisors, fewer faculty, you begin to have an impact on what we really care about, which is the educational achievement of Oregonians. We also received an F in affordability from a national study. So did a lot of other states, but we have what I consider to be a low F, because the amount of grant aid for needy students in this state is far lower than the national average. And that, in fact, makes it difficult for students to attend when tuitions here are probably right around the national average. So if you start out with a lower-than-average need based aid, lower than average per capita personal income, which we have, and average tuition costs, you know that you're going to be less affordable than are many of the other states. We care about all of those warning signs, so we have to have a plan to deal with those. And the key for us is the success of and for Oregonians in terms of participation and degrees. And the three-pronged approach which we're taking include the alignment and partnership with our K-14 partners. And you'll hear a lot about the work that was done to implement Senate Bill 342 that essentially provided clarity for students. The Oregon Transfer Module, a standard approach across all 24 campuses, the community colleges and the university system for advanced placement scores, the Atlas and IDTS systems, which will allow people to track students and allow students to know what it will take to get a degree based on what their current transcripts looks like. The governor's budget includes important investments. The first one is in affordability, which is two-pronged. First prong on that is the shared responsibility model, which in fact will increase the amount of grant aid for needy students in this state and provide a framework in which students will understand that if they participate, they earn certain amount, their parents participate, and they earn certain amount, and if they take advantage of federal aid, that in fact the state will find a way to allow them to afford to go to college. That's an important guarantee. That's an important thing that you will be facing as this session unfolds. But that only works if you can hold the cost of college down enough to make sure that you're not always kind of chasing something that is eluding you. And that's why the board adopted a tuition policy that said that it wants resident undergraduate tuition to increase only at the rate of median family income growth in Oregon, so that we would make university and community college education truly more affordable than it is today by not raising the price just to take advantage of the fact that there's grant aid. That's an important two-pronged effort in order to maintain affordability or to achieve it. Reducing state support to the campuses or to the shared responsibility model will lead either to higher tuition and more debt or to lower enrollment. And that's sort of the ratchet, if you will, effect of those things. The governor's budget also proposes improvements for faculty salaries, student-faculty ratio, funding for regional campuses, some capital repair monies for deferred maintenance, rural access, healthcare workforce investments, engineering technology investment council investments, rural research and development through the Oregon Inc., which is part of the OECDD budget. Those are all important initiatives, which I'm sure we'll get into in some detail. The goals for 2025, really, are the ones that the board is keeping uppermost in its mind. Goals of an educated citizenry, high-quality student learning, creation of original knowledge and the advancement of innovation, and contribution to economic, civic, and cultural life. That's why the strategic priorities of the board are being evolved in the way that they are. That's why the roles of the campuses, which will be discussed beginning next month, will try to frame for the system as a whole how the seven campuses collectively will contribute to meeting those four goals. And with that, I think I will... Oh, I'm supposed to mention. I forgot. We do have a few statutory changes we are proposing. One of those deals with interest earnings, the retention of the interest earnings. Right now, those go to the state treasury. We would propose that we keep them at the university level, and the governor reduced our budget on the general fund side by an amount that was estimated to be the interest earnings, but we think that will let us manage more effectively and efficiently. There's also a proposal on variable rate debt that will have an effect on reducing our cost of some of the capital projects and also some technical amendments on capital budgeting. And those are the three legislative proposals which may come before you that the governor has proposed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chancellor. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, talking about the changing, welcome, Chancellor, first of all, it's good to see you again. Talking about the changing demographics of the system, it seems to me from my experience on campus at Oregon State, at least, and participating in several search committees for some faculty, vice provost, chief financial officer, it's important on a campus for students of color to see role models who are in faculty, and it's, I would guess, largely our lack of ability to offer the kind of packages because many faculty of color are in incredibly high demand, and it seems like that would be part of getting ready for the changing demographic is have a faculty, and that basically costs money because it's expensive.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, I would agree that has been an issue, and you've pointed to one of the key problems that we've had.
Representative Greenlee.
Sure, I'd like to ask a couple of questions if I might.
Go ahead.
One of the important issues that a university system maintains is the question of intergenerational mobility. And the university I went to, when I went to it, had more than half of their students were the first members of a family who had been in college. Do you have any sense of what proportion of the students in the system are first members of families in college, and is that increasing or decreasing, or are there barriers to make that happen more and more?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, that's a very good point. I don't have the statistics, but I do know that some of our campuses focus very, very directly on that as being their main, if you will, area of recruitment. Western is a good example of that, but I can get those numbers for you. I have a sense that it's still a high percentage, but that it's probably not as high as it was in prior generations because of the sort of the saturation of some of the adult workforce in terms of education levels. But I know that some campuses, Western, Eastern, and Southern, focus very, very directly on that population, as does PSU. But frankly, I don't have the system-wide numbers.
You're asking the question, and I'll ask, I think, the following witnesses as well. You've picked as a strategic objective the healthcare workforce, and as part of my other duty here, chairing the healthcare committee, manpower is going to be a huge, huge problem. Could you expand a bit on that strategic objective and how you're moving to achieve that, or how you will be moving?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, there are several different initiatives that are moving forward. In our budget, there's one called the healthcare workforce that focuses on, if you will, it's two-pronged. Part of it is to build science programs in order to train more nursing students at the regional campuses. And the second is to provide more slots for health technology programs that OIT runs. They're in the process right now of building a new health professions center on the Klamath Falls campus that would essentially double their capacity in terms of facilities and equipment. And this budget proposes to increase the faculty in order to be able to use that effectively, and therefore double the number of sonographers and other healthcare technologists that OIT trains. The second strand really comes through the OHSU budget. They are, in addition to the increases that they're proposing for medical and dental education, increasing both in terms of on the Hill and in cooperation with U of O and OSU in Eugene and Corvallis, respectively. In addition to that, they're beginning a new nursing program at Western Oregon University, so that we have then several locations, several different efforts all happening at the same time. We have, as you know better than I do, an aging workforce in healthcare, at a time that we've got an aging population generally, and at the time that the aging population needs the health care, the fear is, at least in some people's part, that all the health care workers will have retired themselves. So we have to deal with this issue.
And I've noticed that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned that our investment in higher education is about 45th in the nation. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, 46th.
46th, even lower. And with that governor's new proposal, where we are going to be? Are we going to be a little higher? Well, how much is going to be higher? And a second question in conjunction with it. You also mentioned the continued decrease of the enrollment in the higher ed. And at the same time, I'm wondering whether private institutions, they are going higher or lower.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, as to the first question, we hope that it will that our relative funding per student will increase from 46th to some number, perhaps two to four slots higher. It depends on what other states do as well. As to the second, our enrollment actually is somewhat higher than it's ever been before. It's just I'm worried about the future. The enrollment at many of the independent institutions also is higher than it has been. Where we've seen the enrollment declines in the last few years in Oregon has been in the community colleges. But I think all of us are concerned about the future and whether or not even those of us who've grown, we expect to be able to continue to do so. We think that this budget will allow us to do so, and will, and more importantly, send a message to Oregonians that the state is investing in their future. The last time that the legislature did that, which is in 1999, immediately there was a big increase in enrollment, and that increase was sustained for several years because the message got out there that education mattered and that it mattered to the state, and the state was going to invest in its people. And my hope, and it's my hope here, is that the same thing can happen this year and that we can reverse these warning signs, and that, in fact, I think we can.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The idea of the shared responsibility model, having been actually a father of a daughter that used that sort of a model, or that sort of a model was used when she first entered college a long, long time ago. at a private school, I found it really rather interesting in an interesting way of doing things. And actually, that was in 93, so it really has been a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And so I find it interesting that we're looking at moving in that direction. And I guess the only question I have is, you know, probably, well, not the only question I have, Mr. Chair, I have a few, but the question around that is there a particular reason why we haven't moved to that sort of a model sooner? And I don't know, Chancellor, maybe you don't know the answer to that question, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think we have been struggling to try to find ways to increase grant aid for some years, partly because of the recession and partly because I don't think we hit on quite the right way to balance the responsibilities. We haven't gotten there. But the last session, the legislature approved a major increase in grant funding, but from a fairly low base. What this does is it builds on that increase, and it then puts a philosophical framework around it that I think makes it easier for us to do two things. One is to say when enough is enough, so that you're not always sort of chasing. The second is to make it clear to people who the partners are and what the responsibility for each partner is, so it becomes clearer to people what it takes and who all is going to help. Part of the problem, I think, is that we have a black box and nobody has really understood how to make affordability work in this state. And I think this helps because it says, student, your role is X. Family, your role is Y. The feds are Z, and therefore the state, I mean, it's much more easily explained and defined. Why we didn't come up with this before, I don't know. But we did this time.
Well, and it's interesting because I think, you know, obviously the school that my daughter went to for her first year of school is most likely not the only school at the time that was using this kind of a model. So I find it interesting that we're just sort of now coming along there. I would surmise that it probably has a lot to do with sort of this anticipation or thought that, you know, if you go to a state school, the price is always a lot less. so you can afford it, so, you know, not putting that out. But you brought up, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, you brought up, Chancellor, an interesting comment with regards to grant and aid for needy students, and thank you for recognizing that although it might have been from a lower base than any of us would have wanted, that the legislature did, in the last legislative session, make a much bigger
yes.
investment in those opportunity grants. So speaking of those, in November, you and staff were before the Joint Legislative Audits Committee, of which I was the co-chair of during the interim. And the number of students taking advantage of, we actually increased the amount of money, but the number of students taking advantage of the Oregon Opportunity Grant went down. Therefore, the amount of money that was expended went down, and so we don't have we didn't need as much money as we invested in there, which I would argue actually we did, and that now we can build on that even more. Care to comment about that,
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell? It was. There were a lot of reasons discussed in November that could have happened, and I won't chronicle all of them now. We spent some time last week looking at the sort of the pickup rates, if you will, to see who actually did pick up his or her award and who didn't, and what the characteristics of those students were. We found that if you were a full-time student and you went to a university, public or private, you were more likely to pick it up. You were just as likely to pick it up as you were in any prior year. But what happened is that for part-time students, particularly in the community colleges, they had not yet gotten to the point of doing the pickups. Now, the part-time is new, so I think the word just hadn't gotten out yet. The second that was speculated last week is, well, if you are a part-time, low-income community college student, the amount of the opportunity grant as it's currently constructed may still not be enough to allow you to go to college. And that is of some concern, but the new design should help deal with that as well. That was part of the discussion that we had last week, because we're trying to puzzle out why and then what do we do. And so we're hopeful that the new design and a lot of work in getting the word out about the program will help a lot. Also, if it's approved early enough in the session that we can, you know, build up support for it in the fall, because really the awards would start a year from now for the following fall, that we'll have something we can work with that will have enough lead time that we can develop a good program and get the word out. And I think that'll have a big impact, particularly for that population of students at the community colleges who had not taken advantage in the past. And so we're very hopeful.
That was, if I may, Mr. Chair, that was kind of an interesting point because yes, I had not mentioned the fact that we also included a broader range of students that could take advantage of the opportunity grant, which I had my doubts about, quite frankly, at the time that we were doing that. But I am very hopeful that students will take advantage of those grants that are available, and the shared responsibility model may really help get that, so that students understand, as they're understanding who has what role and that sort of thing. One other question, if I may, Mr. Chair.
One more,
and that is, I'm going to roll two in.
We do have other presenters too,
and that is with regards to, you mentioned, Chancellor, the budget cuts. And the disinvestment in education. I think one of the things where I think we as a state really shoot ourselves in the foot, you know, except come campaign time, you know, as government is really terrible at messaging. We don't stay on message. We're the hoot. Other than to say, well, you know, everything has always been cut. So my question about the budget cuts is it was it an actual reduction in the number of dollars that were going to the to higher education, or just not as much as had been requested? And I'm going to roll that into this with regards to the role of the campuses. When I worked at Western Oregon several many years ago, one of the concerns that we had at that time was that Western was slated to be closed. And of course, through the work of a lot of people, of which I had very little to do with, matter of fact, I had nothing to do with it, is that the campus is still alive and well and thriving and doing well in a lot of respect. But with regards to the role of the campuses, is there any kind of discussion around closing any campuses going on now, or is it more along the lines of this is, for example, you mentioned Eastern Oregon with regards to the distance education. I agree with you. They do a tremendous job with that. With regards to the roles of the campuses, is that more the slant of the conversation as opposed to, you know, well, we're looking at which ones we can eliminate and that sort of thing? So those two questions. No, I'm done with
it. Mr. Chair, Representative Carroll, we actually, in the current biennium, which is 05-07, have fewer dollars from the state than we had in prior biennium, going back to 99-01. So I think we may be higher than we were in 95-07, but we have a lot more students too. We had 60,000 students back then. We got 80,000 now, and I think so the appropriation may be somewhat higher than it was in 95-07, but it is lower than it was in 99-01. With regard to the roles of campuses, we are focusing right now, the board is focusing right now on the missions of and roles of each of the campuses. Obviously, we have looked at various alternatives if budgets were to be reduced further. Thankfully, with the governor's proposed budget, that is before both houses right now, or at least one of them, we are not having to look at the closure of any of the campuses. Each of them serves a very critical mission. Let's take Western as an example. First-generation students that Western focuses on are students who probably would not be served by any other university because they wouldn't be able to go there. They wouldn't be able to travel there, and they probably wouldn't want to go to an institution as large. So it's you're serving a certain function in each of those campuses, and I fear that if you don't serve that function, that you'll lose many of the students that an individual campus currently serves. So it's not something that we would enter into lightly.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up on that question?
Representative Greenlick?
Has there been any discussion about spinning any of the universities out of the state system into independent status?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, we've had very preliminary discussions in months past. Depending upon what happened with various ballot measures, we might have been more serious in those considerations. But again, those are things, if you do that kind of thing, you're changing the nature and the focus of the institution. And if you're trying to provide, as the board is right now, a strategic vision for an educated state, you want to maintain as many of the connections as you can in order to orchestrate towards that vision. And so I think at this point, we are not considering any of those alternatives.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kremel, with your successful non-participation in helping Western Oregon, I hope maybe that you will non-participate with me to help SOU this year.
To get that going. I'd be glad.
Representative Clem, did you have?
I'll be glad to help too.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick.
I did, and I, after unsuccessfully attempting to get the committee named post-secondary education, I certainly don't now want to give short shrift to the community colleges by hogging all the time with questions for the chancellor as well. So I will be quick. I do just want to get sort of on the record. This was actually a few months before I decided to run for office and had a somewhat instrumental decision to run. And this deals with how the Oregon Opportunity Grant number came in so low. I was testifying as chair of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to the House budget, or whatever they called the split-up committee.
Right.
And the topic came up of what would happen if there were too many people taking advantage of the program or too few. And what has always happened, the statute lays out very clearly, the Student Assistance Commission has the authority to expand the pool or cut the grant size. And I myself have signed letters at Christmas to people telling them their spring term grant would be sliced by $100 per. And it was not easy. That was, I think it was 02. So we had dealt with the downside of it, and I was worried that this expanding new offering would potentially, our forecasting may not be able to accurately tell how many people were there. I asked the panel to please not place a budget note on the budget that stripped, for the first time in 30 years, the commission's authority to make adjustments. It didn't do it, though, as a problem. So the commission could not respond to the, and I think the chancellor successfully captured maybe why the pickup rate was low. The commission could have released that at least some portion of those dollars, and several thousand more grants could have been had if that budget note had not been placed on there. And I was very unhappy, as chair of the commission, having been on the downside. So please be careful for Ways and Means members out there in the world, myself included now, about the use of budget notes, because we do have boards and commissions who have conducted public hearings all over the state and are granted statutory authority, and using a budget note to set a policy was, I felt, not appropriate, and it had really deleterious effects.
Point well made.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clem. Mr. Chancellor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Two brief questions. I'll ask one just on the rural student demographic. Are there specific programs that the system is putting into place to recruit rural students?
Mr. Chair, yes. Contained within the budget is a rural access initiative that will be spearheaded by Eastern Oregon University and currently includes also Southern and OIT.
Thank you very much. And just one last question. What do you teach?
Public administration, public budgeting.
How's that going for you?
It's always fun. It's always fun.
Well, we really greatly appreciate your time here. Appreciate your work. The shared responsibility model is an excellent step forward. I salute you for what you're doing. I look forward to working with you for the rest of the session.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it as well. Thank you all.
Mr. Chair, maybe while the transition's occurring, the other thing I did want to mention
briefly.
Well,
let me call them up. Yeah. Oh, could the representatives from the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development come up? How many folks do we have?
Just the commissioner.
Just the commissioner. Very good. And so we're going to pick these up separately?
We'd like to come together.
Please do. Please come together. We'd love to see you together. Representative Clem.
I just wanted to mention the Gear Up program is something that, with federal partners, state system, it's not the state system anyway, Oregon University system, does to help, starting at the junior high level, students think about college.
Right.
The Aspire program is really the high school program, it's all privately funded currently, and that helps people know about the Opportunity Grant plus other options. So those of us who can and should support the governor's package to put some general fund and be able to, I think, almost double the number of high schools who have the Aspire program, plus the work in Gear Up will help with the people having a general knowledge of the monies that we or others make available, because sometimes that's sadly part of the problem. They just don't know where to go even though the money's there.
Absolutely.
And so we have some solutions in this budget. Well, that I'm
pleased with that as a lead-in, where should they go?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Cam Preuss-Frawley. I'm the Commissioner of Community Colleges and the Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Many thanks for the invitation to come and give you an overview of the department. You're getting two pieces of paper. The teal-colored packet will be the one that I'm going to speak from, and then my colleague Andrea Henderson, who is the executive director of the Oregon Community College Association, has the also a set of handouts. I would like to make sure that you all know that I am not associated with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I'm not certain that Representative Clem, being the expert that he is, that I would want to be sitting here. And Dennis Johnson has some preparation to do, I think. No, it's a good thing. Very briefly, and watching your time and knowing that we will likely be invited back to have further conversation in considerable more depth, what's the information that I brought for you today is sort of a 50,000-foot view of the department. We do administer about $700 million a biennium. Most of that is passed through. It's passed through to the 17 community colleges. We have 19 providers that deliver adult basic skills. Most of those are community colleges, but we do have a community-based organization that also provides basic skills and English as second language services. We provide about $110 million a biennium of federal workforce dollars to seven workforce investment areas around the state. We also administer the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps program. That's available in all 36 counties across the state. And the primary delivery system for workforce development is through the 17 community colleges and Oregon Worksource Oregon centers. I have a couple of factoids. The Chancellor provided you with, I think, for all of us, a good context about why education matters. We certainly feel that we have a very important role to play in ensuring that Oregon has a globally competitive workforce, and through our services, through both the community college and the workforce development partners, serve about 350,000 students a year. Of that, I think the Chancellor already indicated the number of community college students that transfer from community colleges to the university system. That number is gaining, even as we see a decline overall of community college enrollments over the last several years, again, because of a lack of investment and rising tuition. We still see that number of students who start at community colleges and then continue on the university system and independent colleges here in the state is on a positive trend up. I would also bring your attention to the governor has, through an executive order, established a program called the Employer Workforce Training Fund. And we use about $6 million a year of federal workforce dollars to invest in incumbent workers. That's people that are already working to ensure that they have the skills that their employer needs at this moment. So perhaps when they were hired, they didn't have a lot of skills, or they had the skills that they needed, but as the company has tried to retain its competitiveness and productiveness, it has a need for change in technology or other areas. And we have, in the last 3 years, trained 23,000 Oregonians who are currently working. It's a very popular program. We require a dollar-for-dollar match from the employer. We do exceed our match requirements all over the state, even in the rural parts of the state, although there is a, I would have to say, there's a larger struggle for more rural businesses to find the match, but it doesn't have to be cold cash. It can be in kind and release time and things like that. But we see that as a very important aspect of the grow your own strategy for Oregon, rather than importing a lot of talent, which we do. Oregon and Colorado are the two states that import the most bachelor degreed individuals in the nation, but we believe that we must take great interest in find programs that will help Oregonians gain the skills that they need through the community colleges. Of those 23,000 in the last 3 years, better than 50% of them were trained at a community college. The business has the opportunity to choose a private provider, a vendor that they bring in, or to contract with the community college. And we are most pleased that, again, the trend line for using the community college for that kind of training on-site at the business with these federal workforce dollars is on the increase. I'm looking at the overview page that's on the right-hand side, and on the back, you all know where your community college is or where your neighboring community college is, but we have a map that gives you the where all 17 community colleges across the state are located, and also a small picture of what are the mission and vision statements of the 17 community colleges. Again, there is, and Andrea, I think, will make this point as well, that each community college is independent. It has a locally elected board of 7 members. They are individually chartered across the state, and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development has what we call a light touch policy role with those 17 community colleges. But when you ask them where their commonality is, you can see it reflected in their vision and mission statements. There's a lot of commonality in the comprehensive community colleges across the state. Another grounding that I'd like to give you is an organizational picture, not necessarily of the department, but there is on the left-hand side of your packet the policy priorities and governance of the department specifically. We are under the auspices and authority and oversight of the State Board of Education. It's a K-14 board, we have listed there on the right-hand side the State Board of Education and its mission and goals. Then on the left-hand side of that particular piece of paper, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which has responsibility for much of the federal dollars that come to the department, their mission and goals. And then in the center is the Joint Boards of Education, which is a PK-20 board, which is really looking at the coordination of all of these efforts and their mission and goals. And I bring this picture to you because if periodically I act a little schizophrenic, it's because I have reason to. I do believe that the Department of Community Colleges is a workforce development entity, but we also have very specific dollars to do very specific workforce development things. At the bottom of that page is the education enterprise target, and when you hear from James Sager from the governor's office, the education advisor, we are currently operating under this particular target that Oregon will increase the number of professional certificates and associate degrees to 40%, and 40% of our citizens will have a bachelor's degree, and only 20% will have a high school diploma. That would be their lowest level of education. That's what we believe we need in order to have the highly competitive, globally competitive workforce that Oregon needs. I'm going to move now to a colorful handout, which is the budget picture for community colleges. I make, Andrea and I usually do this in tandem, and sometimes we get off sync, but we tend to get around to all 17 of the college boards every year. And when it's a budget year or a legislative year, I like to take something that I can leave with them so they know not simply about their community college, but about all 17 community colleges. So that's what this overview is intended to do. I'm very briefly let you know, when you look at the two graphs on the front page, we're talking about what's happening with enrollments in community colleges. The chancellor certainly gave you the heads up that we had been in decline. Both full-time and part-time students are up from our low in 2003-04, but we haven't yet reached our high point of 2001-02, where we had over 400,000 students enrolled. Our full-time equivalent is at 91,000. We're slowly coming back up, and if you open this particular handout, this gives you a picture of what has been happening with funding what the major revenues of community colleges are. They include property tax for the local community colleges tuition and the state general fund. And on page three, what does it mean for community college students that that more are enrolling, but we're still 49,000 students below where we were at our peak. And the graph at the bottom of page three is a very telling snapshot of why many of those 49,000 students have not yet returned, because course offerings are still lagging behind. We've added about 7% more in the last year of course offerings, not like we used to. The story today is that if you're not on line at 12:01 when registration starts at a community college, by 12:05 all the math courses are full. And in 2001, if that were the case, the college would have been keeping a waiting list, and as soon as they had a dozen or so, they'd open another section because they had the resources to do that. They don't have the resources to do that today. The back page is what's going on with capital construction. You may recall that in 2005, community colleges did receive the first funding in 25 years for state Article 11G bonds to match local dollars that had been raised. Well, we are back in 07 with an additional request. Six colleges were funded. There are 12 colleges that are in the governor's budget this time, and this explains to you the process that we went through. Now, very quickly, because you did ask for legislative priorities, there is in the packet a piece that is update and titled Update and Legislative Priorities. What we did is pose to ourselves five questions about how ready was Oregon to have a globally competitive workforce, and to answer the question, why does education matter? So the first question, are Oregonians prepared for life, work, and careers? And you see the indented part there, just for the sake of time. That's the governor's recommended budget that we believe responds to putting students first. The second area of activity is an employer advantage. And I need to tell you, these are not in priority order. They are in order to answer questions that we asked ourselves. And I can certainly provide you the priority order. Not surprisingly, it is the Community College Support Fund, which is our number one priority. And following that is capital construction. Following that are some of the investments that are listed here. You'd heard the chancellor talk about the healthcare workforce initiative. I wanted to make sure that you knew that community colleges are in partnership with OHSU and the university system in a $2.2 million general fund increase. That increase will go to all 17 colleges as they expand, not just nursing, but other allied health programs. It remains the strongest and most widely spread shortage area in the state.
Chairman, I ask a question.
Representative Greenlee.
2 million over 17 institutions, that's not very much money, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, no, it is not, but and it does fall short of what we would need or what we asked for, but each college will receive some resources to expand their programs. And if you'd like the detail of that, I can certainly bring it back.
I would. Thank you. You can send it to me directly.
I'll do that. Thank you.
JD, continue on.
Well, I anticipate that all of you can read, so I'm not going to take you through all of this. I did want to make sure that on page 3 of this particular handout, is Oregon post-secondary education affordable for Oregonians? You just spent quite a lot of time talking about the shared responsibility model. I want to make sure that you are keying in that it's critically important to community college students, and the expansion of the program to part-time students is I wouldn't say a boon, but it's certainly it's necessary, and we're glad to see it. And the fact that we do not have the take-up rate that we were anticipating, I think, is simply a lack of communicating to the student early enough for them to know that they could access it. And we are working on multiple fronts to make sure that all students, whether they're at a community college, a high school, and not yet to college, or in the university and independent system, know that there is an increase in financial aid for students. I need to bring to your attention there is an investment in the governor's budget called the Skill Up Oregon Fund. It's a $10 million proposed corporate minimum, a use for the corporate minimum increase. It would be targeted to the nearly, it would not serve all of them, but it's targeted to individuals in Oregon who don't yet have a high school diploma, who cannot start on their way to a high-wage job if they don't have some basic foundational skills. So that fund is critical for that, and community colleges will play a critical role in that funding. I think I'm going to stop because I want to make sure that Andrea has sufficient time, and I think we might actually be a little redundant if I don't.
Andrea, but before you go, members, do you have any quick questions?
Two. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cam, refresh my memory. Is the shared responsibility model in the governor's budget document also sort of talked about in the context of the corporate minimum and almost contingent on corporate minimum income?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, yes, it is.
Yeah, so that's an important thing to note for those who have now been talking about the shared responsibility model. That's the way it's paid for there. I've heard discussions that it's not the only option, but that's important. And then the other piece, I guess, just after 13 years now of advocating solely for basically access and financial aid for low-income Oregonians, I see what happens when all you have is access and no capacity, which is at 1201, everybody packs up and you've got a great piece of financial aid package and you can't use it. And so the I don't even think this support fund is actually sufficient. I know that our folks here are required to say that, but I have my opinions and I'm entitled to them now.
So even before you were elected, you were entitled to your opinion.
Yeah, I kept them myself, I swear. Thank you, Mr.
Can I just follow very very briefly?
Representative Greenlick.
That really comes into the health care issue, because I hear from constituents and I hear from legislators around the state that one of the problems of people who want to go into the nursing program is they can't get the classes they need as pre-nursing requisites because there just isn't the capacity. So, I mean, there's this bottleneck really early in the system that we need to find some way to do something about, and it's that 1201 problem.
That's
right.
That's
a huge problem.
It's not going to be a big problem.
That's right. I just had just one comment on the Skill Up program. I went to a presentation in Jackson County where it's estimated 2,400 job openings exist in Jackson County right now without workers who qualify for those positions. So it's phenomenal. I'm glad to see it on the budget. Chair, would you like to take some time here?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. Thank you very much for this opportunity to come speak to you today. I also have a handout. It is looks like this. I'm not going to speak directly from the handouts here, but did want to provide some charts and graphs that I thought might be helpful. One of those that is in there is a small governance chart. So for those of you who see both Cam and I up here, it kind of delineates what her role is and what my role is with community colleges. As Cam mentioned, our community colleges are each independent. They're governed by a locally elected 7-member board. Those independent community colleges formed an association in 1962, which is the Community College Association. And I report to a 34-member board, which is each which is each community college president and one board member from each community college that is on my board. With that, I wanted to spend some time today talking about two items. The first is some of the work that the Community College Association underwent during the interim on our strategic planning process, and to bring you up to date in terms of what the colleges are talking about. And then secondly, to talk about our legislative agenda, which flows from that strategic plan. The community colleges over this last interim for the first time came together to talk about actually crafting a strategic plan that all 17 colleges and their local boards could approve. It's not an item that the colleges collectively have done in the past, so it really is a change in the way that the community colleges are operating for them to collectively look at how can they best collaborate to improve services for Oregonians and for their students. So in that process, they did create a strategic plan that my board adopted in December, and I do have in your handout the five goals that were crafted in that strategic plan. It's towards the back. But what I wanted to do before getting into the specific goals is just to give you some of the information that I think was very informative to our community colleges as they are crafting the plan. Some of the information you heard earlier today from George Bernsteiner, because we're all very aware of the trends in Oregon, how we are serving or not serving Oregonians that need post-secondary education. I have in my materials the same charts that George had earlier that look at the education attainment. And I think it's important that they're in both sets because this is a very critical issue, I think, for Oregon. The fact that our older generation has a higher education level, I think, really asks a very important policy question about where Oregon's going and what kind of jobs we will have in the future. And that was a very critical piece for our colleges as they were looking at their strategic plan. Some of the other important factors is the general knowledge that if you look at the jobs, in 1950, 70% of the jobs were unskilled jobs, or excuse me, 65%. Now only 20% of the jobs out there are unskilled jobs. We haven't caught up to that trend yet. And we also have information that shows that the fastest growing jobs in Oregon are those jobs that require an associate's degree. And recent information from the Oregon Workforce Investment Board predicts that approximately 700,000 skilled jobs are going to be filled over the next several years, either through new jobs that are created or through retirements. And again, the key question is, are we prepared to actually meet those needs so that we don't have a situation like in Southern Oregon where there's jobs that are going unfilled because of a lack of people that actually have the skills to fill them? So those were all kind of key critical factors as we were looking at our strategic plan. And we also found information from the Education Commission on the States that did a study in 2003 that looked at the participation gap throughout the country in post-secondary education and actually did a state-by-state prediction in terms of what should our goals be for each state in terms of post-secondary education participation. Based on that study, they predicted that Oregon should be serving an additional 106,000 students in post-secondary education by the year 2015. So that's in addition to the students that we're already serving. We took those key facts into consideration as we were crafting our strategic plan, and it may be no surprise that our first goal in there is around access. We think it's critical that we increase access for our community colleges and for all of post-secondary education. And we crafted in our first goal to increase access by 100,000 in the year 2020. Essentially, we took the Education Commission of the States, rounded it down to 100,000, and gave us an additional 5 years to get there. to see what we could do. We also deliberately, you'll notice in the goal, it does not say community college students. It does say post-secondary education. That was very deliberate in that we play part of the continuum in post-secondary education. Part of our mission is to transfer students onto the university system, and part of our mission is to serve those students who are seeking a two-year associate's degree. They're both important goals, in addition to all of the other parts of the community college mission. So we wanted to recognize that continuum and that we have a leadership responsibility to be part of that continuum. The other goals that we came up with in our strategic plan, the second one in there is essentially around quality, that it can't just be access to anything, but it needs to be access to a quality education. And to help pursue that quality goal, we have recently started in a partnership with both Cam and myself to have one person that's really looking at our benchmarks and our accountability measures in Oregon. Essentially, we think we're doing a good job in Oregon, but we could do even better, and we're looking at how can we plan to ensure that we have a strong accountability system for quality education in the future. Our third and fourth goals were around our leadership within the education sector and increasing the way in which community colleges collectively make decisions on a statewide basis. Which brings me to our fifth goal, which is around investments in community colleges. Obviously, to increase our access, we do need to have an investment in community colleges, and that is the foundation for our legislative agenda for this upcoming session. We have three parts to what we believe is important to invest in to increase access. As been referenced here earlier, access isn't just having financial aid. It's also having the ability to actually have programs to increase our course sections, to have new programs to meet the needs of the community. It's also to have adequate buildings for our community colleges. Some of our colleges, to use one example, Lynn Benton Community College has a proposal to increase, to build a new science building and to retrofit their current science building. They're turning away approximately 3,500 students a year in their science education that can't get in. And the major obstacle for them is their actual facility. I had the opportunity to tour their facility earlier this year. It was designed many years ago. It's no longer the right type of design to serve students. It has very large projection rooms when they used to have projectors to educate that way. And there's just by redesigning it and adding on to the space, they will be able to accommodate a lot more students so they can actually offer those increased class sections. So we do have all three of those needs, and we believe that all three of them have to be looked at in conjunction with each other. We have three parts of our agenda. On the financial aid, we are supporting the governor's recommendation for financial aid and the shared responsibility model. And we think that is a very important step in this session to have that funded so we can ensure that students that need the financial aid have the opportunity to access it. The second part of our agenda is around the capital construction. We had a request that went into the governor's office for 15 capital construction projects. The governor did put 12 of those projects into his budget. We would still like to advocate for all 15 of them. We think that it is important. A lot of work was done to actually put those projects into a prioritized list, and we would like to support that prioritized list of projects. And then our third area is around the support fund. The governor's budget does put $483 million into our support fund. It is an increase from where we are now. Our current budget is at approximately $428 million, which is in actual dollars still a decrease from where we were funded in the 2001 legislative session. So we are not back up to where we were funded for a very brief period of time before special sessions took the money away in 2001. Our request on our support fund is for $529 million. Essentially, that will allow the majority of our colleges to begin making investments to increase access, to add the course sections, and to add programs that will help Oregonians be trained to get family wage jobs. At $483 million, our colleges will essentially be able to not make cuts, which is a good position to be in, but it does not allow them to make the investments to actually start to grow their enrollment. I would point out, though, that even at 529, we do have a couple of colleges that will still be making cuts. Certainly, Chair Buckley knows that his local community college, Rogue Community College, is one of those. But we are asking for an investment so that the bulk of our colleges can begin to turn the page here and begin to offer more programs. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Members, we do have time.
Yes. Thank you very much, Andrew. You mentioned that the out of 17, 15 were able to fund for the capital construction. Mm-hmm. And my question is, among the community college applied for it, didn't get it. And can you give us the information, what was the criteria that they included and not included, why the amount of the community college is out? What I understand, when the community college board members called the governor's office, they didn't give us a good explanation why. maybe you might be able to give me some information about that.
Chair Buckley, representative.
Not now, later. Yeah.
Whatever. Chair Buckley, Representative Lim. I don't have the information available as to what how the decision was made in terms of which colleges were included. In terms of the OCCA legislative agenda, we are strongly supportive of Mount Hood Community College's project, and we'll be lobbying the session to have that project included on the list. It was our number three project. We do think it's very important and would hope to have it included.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Now that we know one of the three, what are the other two?
Chair Buckley, Representative Klim. The other two projects that were not funded was Shemeketa's project, which was number 13 on our list. It is the second project for Shemeketa on the list, but it was through our priority system, did receive a high priority ranking and were supportive of that project. The third project that was not funded was Klamath Community College's project. It was number 15 on our list. Klamath Community College is still seeking to have a permanent large campus. Mm-hmm. That is our newest community college. It was formed in 1997. Mm-hmm. They did receive money in the last legislative session, but will be seeking a bond to match, hopefully, both investments so that they can put together a permanent campus for their institution.
Any other questions?
I have one more question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Concerning the, I don't know who should ask, but the tuition, the full-time tuition student's fee is about little more than $3,000.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what I understand is one of the highest in the western states. And then how high we are compared to California, Washington, or neighbor states. And could you give us also an idea how could we improve that? Other than asking more money, but you know, of course, that's not the answer. But.
Chair Buckley, Representative Lim, we do have very high tuition in Oregon. I don't have at my fingertips the comparison to Washington, California, other than I know that we are higher than both of them. I'd be happy to get you the specific information comparing Oregon to the other western states in terms of tuition. Essentially, tuition is high because as community colleges have had less funding, each of our locally elected boards have tried to figure out what's the best combination of cuts that is going to benefit students. I mean, it's a difficult decision to make. And in many cases, preserving the programs and raising tuition benefited the students in that they would have a program to actually attend. It's a difficult decision because any decision you make, you are shutting the door to students, whether you raise the tuition or whether you cut the program. So it's been a combination of the two, but many of our colleges have drastically raised tuition.
Okay, so if you could provide me or the members, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative.
I'm not trying to snuggle up.
You're just trying to get out of the way of Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to make it easier for...
Kim, can I ask, with the Joint Boards of Education, just out of curiosity, how often do the Joint Boards meet?
Chair Buckley, by statute, they should meet, I believe, two times a biennium. Am I right?
Yes.
Thank you, James.
Very good.
Actually, we're a little bit ahead of schedule. I think we will meet three times this biennium. Certainly, we have. It was a meeting that seemed to fall in the priority list between the two boards working diligently on their individual tasks. But the governor made it quite clear that he expected joint work around alignment and transparency of budget, and we have been making progress on that.
I wish you the best of luck in that.
Thank you.
Members, we do have just a few more minutes. I want to thank you both for your presentation. Thank you for being here today. We look forward to all the more detailed discussions to come as we move through the proposals this session. Members, we do have just a few more minutes before we can comfortably exit the room prior to the next committee starting. So I wanted to give the opportunity, if there is anybody in the audience who did not sign up to speak, that did want to offer any comments, there is a few minutes to do so.
But seeing no one rushing to the microphone, I will thank the members for your attention and for your questions today, and I will close this hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, 14th, with you.
Thank you. All right. Very much. My favorite topic.